Now I've got this.
Oh, you got that.
I don't need that. No. Hello there. Right, lovely to be with you. My name's Steve Carroll. I'm a partner here. I usually go to the Six, but I always love coming here. And it's great to see you all. We're going to continue with our series on Joseph. And we've already looked at this. Have you ever been blamed for something you didn't do? And I'm not going to have the opportunity to go around and ask you, because this isn't therapy, sorry. But you know, I'm sure there was a very personal stories there, and but that's really where we find ourselves. I think you probably know pain from those things. You know, we had somebody in the breakfast church this morning, and they were saying that they got lied about. They were, you know, terrible things were said about them. People turned against this person, and it took them 6 months to get over it. And it would take a long time to get over something like that. But that's where we find Joseph. We find Joseph in prison, and for something he didn't do. In fact, he did the very opposite of what he was accused of doing. He's went to work in the house of a man called Potiphar in Egypt. He did very well. His wife made advances to him. Joseph said, no, how could I do it? It's against Potiphar and against God. And he ran off. He literally ran away from her. And then she lied, turned it round, and said it was actually Joseph who made the advance, and he ended up in prison. So he's in prison for something he didn't do. Now let's turn to our passage. We're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 40, starting at verse 1. Let's read this. Sometime later, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them after they had been in custody for some time. Each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were being held in prison, had a dream the same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. When Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. So he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in his master's house, why do you look so sad today? We both had dreams, they answered, but there is no one to interpret them. Then Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dream. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at 3 points. I'm going to go ask, how did we get here? How did we get to this passage? What's gone before? I'm going to talk about Joseph's prison experience. And finally, the interpretation of dreams. Now, I've really enjoyed this service. We've had some really great messages. And we started off with Jason talking about the fumes of favoritism and the fragrance of grace. The fact that Joseph's family was marred, going right back to his granddad's generation, it was marred with this whole problem of favoritism. And this favoritism wasn't good. It always ended up, you know, really causing problems. But even though there was this favoritism, there was also the fragrance of grace. Grace meaning undeserved love. God's undeserved love still came through. It still overruled the folly and the stupidity of humans. And then Ian gave us an excellent explanation of the sovereignty of God, which is a very important thing, I believe, for Christians, where you're talking basically about despite human evil, despite human folly, God still wins. His purposes still work out. And that's what the sovereignty of God is about. And very much, I think, that's what the story of Joseph is about. And then Matt took us through the pattern of Joseph's life looks forward to that of Jesus. That Joseph is almost, there's a word in theology, it's called typology, okay? Nothing to do with typewriters. They don't use those anymore, do they? No. Okay, let's move on. Typology is basically like in the Old Testament, you get a type of Christ. And Joseph is a type of Christ in that there's a pattern in the way in which he lives which mirrors that of Jesus Christ. And that was very helpful. And of course, it was. The pastor gave it. But what I want to talk about, first of all, is Joseph's prison experience. Now, in chapter 39, verse 21, it says, "But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favour in the eyes of the prison warden." Well, that's all right then, isn't it? You know, nothing. It's like a holiday camp, isn't it, really? But I just want you to imagine what an ancient Egyptian prison was actually like. Okay, they didn't have parole officers, they didn't have solicitors coming in, they didn't have anybody campaigning for prisoners' rights or anything like that. The sanitation would have been absolutely dreadful. I don't think the food would have been that good either. It was pretty horrible. In fact, Joseph, in Genesis 40, verse 15, in the Bible I read, the ESV, which is the extremely serious version, he actually refers to it as the pit. I think the NIV says the dungeon. It really was not a holiday camp at all. It was pretty terrible. But what I'm interested in, what is Joseph's sort of psychological position? What would it have been like to be him in that situation? Knowing for one thing that he's in prison for something that he didn't do. And there is a temptation towards bitterness towards that, not just towards that, but bitterness towards his brothers who've already sold him into slavery. He's got a lot of baggage there. But one of the things I was thinking about this. Joseph had no scriptures, okay? He couldn't open the book of Genesis and say, "Oh, it all works out in the end, I end up getting out." You know, because they weren't written. The first scriptures were actually compiled by Joseph, and that was going to be a few hundred years. And ahead of him, he had no scriptures. He couldn't look at the type of things that Matt was talking about last week, and he couldn't say, "Oh well, it's all right because my life kind of reflects in some ways that of the Messiah," because he didn't know the Messiah was going to come. He didn't know anything about Israel becoming a world power. He didn't know anything about God leading the children of Israel back into Jerusalem after the Exodus. He knew nothing about the coming Messiah, about the book of Revelation, nothing at all. He had no scriptures. And yet, he was faithful to God. There's no grumbling, there's no bitterness. He was faithful to God. He had no church history. He had no testimonies or apologetics. So Joseph had no church history. He couldn't look back and think to himself, "Well, back in the medieval period, the church had gone completely over to superstition, but God raised men who actually fought this and actually brought the church back to the Bible." It's called the Reformation. He couldn't say, "Well, in England, it had actually gone to pot. It was almost anarchy. But God raised up people like George Whitefield and Charles and John Wesley." And he couldn't look at that, and he couldn't say to himself, "Well, you know, God works." You know, he couldn't look at how William Wilberforce actually, you know, and his colleagues ended up banning slavery because Christians got together and they stopped having sugar in their tea. They did a boycott on sugar, and they actually could have really crippled the British Empire in what they did, but they did it for God. And they ended up banning the slave trade. He couldn't look back on stories like that. He couldn't look at testimonies because he didn't know any testimonies. I started going to the seniors, and for some reason that causes a ripple of laughter. Phil, stop it. There's nothing funny about going to the seniors, okay? I went there and Dame Julie said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm 65 and I don't understand young people anymore. So I'm coming here." And at the seniors, we have testimonies. We had a wonderful testimony of a lady who'd lived through the Second World War. I'd like to know what it's like to live through the Second World War as a Christian, to wake up and not know if you're going to be alive or your friends are going to be alive or if your school or your house or your entire street has been bombed out of existence. I'd like to know what it was like to hold on to Christ in those times. We know that. We have testimonies. And also apologetics. Apologetics are the intellectual reasons for or the defense of the Christian faith. Did you see on the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, the headline of the Sunday Times was, "Does God exist? Modern science says he must." How about that? He had nothing. He knew nothing about the evidence for the resurrection. He knew nothing about the manuscript evidence for the Bible, the manuscript evidence for the New Testament. He had none of that. What did he have to go on? Joseph's knowledge of God was from a dysfunctional family who had betrayed him. Now, there were other gods. The Egyptians had gods. They had gods who were very much like aspects of human nature. In fact, the ancient world did that. So there would be always, for some reason, there's always a god of lust. It's always a goddess for some reason. No idea why. And there's always the Egyptians had a god of creativity. His name was Ta. How about that? Ta. Can you all say that? Ta. Okay. And it's spelled P-T-U-H. Okay, say it again. Ta. Okay, god of creativity. But all of these gods were just basically based on aspects of human nature. They weren't the god that his family believed in, the god of the Hebrews, the god of the Bible, the god of the universe, who is above everything, who cannot bear to have idols made because they're an insult to him. He's so high up. That's the god he believed in. And his only witness was his family. It was just his family who knew about it. And they'd betrayed him. They'd let him down. And they weren't a very good bunch. You know, his dad, was a bit crafty, a bit of a Del Boy character. And, this is what he had to go on. And yet he was still so faithful. We have all this. We have the whole scriptures. We have prophecies that have been fulfilled. Old Testament prophecies fulfilled in Christ. We have the church history. We've seen, we can look, if we bother to look, we can see how God has actually defended his people, been with his people throughout the dark ages of history, throughout wars, throughout revolutions. We've got testimonies. People in our church who've gone through really dark times and come out the other side. We've got apologetics. Reasons why we it's totally defensible intellectually to believe in Christianity. Joseph had none of those things, and yet he had such great faith. Faith that would put us to shame. In the New Testament, there's a letter called Hebrews, and nobody knows exactly who wrote it, but it's written to Christians. And there's a list in Hebrews 11 of men and women of great faith. And it goes, by faith, Abraham, so by faith, Noah, by faith, Joseph, by faith, David. And it goes through all the great characters of the Old Testament who by faith accomplished so much. And then it goes into Hebrews 12, where it says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out before us. There's a wonderful quote by Jim Packer, J.I. Packer. He's still alive. He lives in Vancouver. He's a British Anglican theologian who wrote a wonderful book called Knowing God. Anybody remember that book? Fantastic book. Yeah, thank you. Some hands going up. Fantastic book. And I always remember this one line from it. I can remember a bit more than just that. But there's this. He says that one could reconstruct the God Joseph believed in by his behavior in prison. You can have no knowledge of the God of the Hebrews whatsoever. Your knowledge of gods is polytheism, is the stone figures that the Egyptians worshipped. But you could know about this God because of the behavior of Joseph in prison. And it's a great challenge to us because we live in a time when people aren't reading the Bible. They don't have the same religious education that we had. You know, when I was 15, when we did RE, religious education, we studied the Gospels. And that was studying the Gospel of Mark as a teenager was one of the things that led me to Christ. That doesn't happen so often now. I don't think so. But people aren't their knowledge of the Bible is gone. But you are the only Bible they'll ever come across. Now, if you're feeling uncomfortable, you're not feeling anything like as uncomfortable as I am, because I know how much I've failed God. I know how much I've let God down. In your workplace, with your family, do you represent this God, or do you represent yourself and your gripes and your sense of unfairness? That's the challenge that comes through the life of Joseph. Where is our faith? When we have so much to go on, where is our faith? Okay, we're going to go now to the second part of this talk. And I'm going to ask you to, in your groups, twos or threes, I'd just like you to ask this question. Do you think God has ever spoken to you in a dream? Not yes. Talking to yourself. Okay, better get on. I hope you found that helpful. I believe God has spoken to me in dreams. I've had a very dramatic situation once where I was completely confused by a certain theological issue, you know, and I cried out to God to understand it, and I had a dream, which was so powerful that, you know, when I woke up, I quickly wrote it down. It was so powerful. I believe God does speak to us in dreams. Let's now have a look at our scriptures. Let's go back to Genesis 40. Let's try with your right eye. So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said to him, "In my dream, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and put the cup in his hand." "This is what it means," Joseph said to him. "The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand, just as you used to do when you were his cupbearer." And then with the other eye. "But when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon." When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, "I too had a dream. On my head were three baskets of bread. In the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head." "This is what it means," Joseph said. "The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and impale your body on a pole, and the birds will eat away your flesh." I bet that made his day. So these are two dreams. I just want to talk now about the interpretation of dreams, because the interpretation of dreams was very important in the ancient world. Yet again, it was important in Babylon, many places. I mean, you think about it, dreams are pretty powerful, aren't they? You have these dreams, what on earth are they going? Has anybody had a dream where it's really shaking you up, and the next day you're sort of like this, you know, like that? Yeah, well, of course, and so to ancient people, this would have been something very powerful. What does it mean? And they used to go to, basically, like, source sorcerers, and then there were sorcerers who would interpret their dreams. That's why the cupbearer and the baker, and they said, well, we had dreams and we got nobody to interpret them because they couldn't get to a sorcerer. And of course, you know, in the Bible, yes, God does speak through dreams. You know, we've already seen with Joseph, he spoke through dreams. Daniel, we go into the New Testament with Joseph, the husband of Mary. An angel appeared in a dream and said, no, take Mary as your wife. Dreams and visions, they're all the way through the Bible. And we might think that this is an ancient thing, but it's not. This is a picture of Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, who towards the end of the 19th century wrote a book on the interpretation and the analysis of dreams. And Freud had a huge impact upon 20th century thinking, and it carries on today into the 21st century. But there's a problem with Freud. When I was at college, one of our lecturers pointed out that you can't actually experience somebody else's dream, okay? So if Josh comes to me and he says, I've just had a dream, I can't actually get inside his head. What Josh has to do is he has to choose words to describe his dream, okay? Just like this visual, sort of like this. No, words to describe his dream. And all I've got are those words. I can't experience the dream. Does that make sense? Okay, so a lot of this stuff that Freud was talking about, some people are a little bit iffy about it. But what did Joseph say? He says, do not interpretations belong to God? So you may have a dream, but nobody, you know, really, you may choose to share it, but no psychoanalysis, no sorcerer, and no preacher can actually tell you exactly what it means. Only God can tell you what it means. And I think that what Joseph was doing there, without realizing it prophetically, he was pointing towards the scriptures that would be given to the people of God. Because only God's interpretation can possibly be right. And there's a lot of bad things that have happened by people relying just on dreams or visions. There was this situation, I think it was in America, where there was a man saying that the rapture was going to happen any minute now. I can't remember, but it was sometime in September, wasn't it? And that God was just going to take everybody up, all the Christians up to heaven. And people were even selling their houses, selling their cars, selling everything as a sign of faith, that because this was going to happen. Now, if any of them had actually opened their Bibles, they'd say that even Jesus didn't know when it was going to happen. So how can somebody, you know, some preacher know when it's going to happen when even Jesus doesn't know when the end of the world, when these things are going to happen? If they'd read their Bibles, they wouldn't have done something so stupid and made the Christianity look stupid. But terrible things have happened through people interpreting dreams but not interpreting them through the Bible, or not having the Bible next to it. Say, does that sound like a biblical explanation? Because the Bible isn't just the interpretation of dreams, it's also the interpretation of life. And it's something that we need to be reading, it's something that we need to be knowing about. It should be the environment, a mental environment in which we live, the scriptures. There's some incredible things happening at the moment around the world. When Charlie Kirk got shot a few weeks ago, more people were going to church in America after that than had been going before. There's things happening in France, where there's more baptisms happening in France than there's ever been. There's things happening in this country that are fantastic. But one of the things that concerns me is that it's not a spiritual movement, but it's a nationalist movement. That it's about Christian identity, not Christian repentance. It's about Christians fighting back. It's not about Christian living and Christian forgiving. And somebody showed me a quote this morning, actually, after I spoke on this. They said that you know, the Christian gospel is about love. Christian nationalism is about fear and hate. And we must be people like Joseph, who have this personal faith, this personal walk with God that actually makes a difference to our lives, so that people can look at us and they can know what the true God is like. So I'm going to leave it there. Next week, Matt will continue with this story. We know, of course, that the cupbearer did not keep his promise and Joseph remained in prison for some time and he was yet again betrayed. We'll see how that ends. But what I like to do is invite the musicians back up. Thank you very much.